Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's episode 61 of Game On with Cody and John.
This is Game On with Cody and John, the uncommon podcast for the common gamer, bringing you the latest and greatest from the world of tabletop gaming, board games, card games, RPGs, and miniatures wargaming, news and discussions on gaming and gamer culture, plus reviews of some of the best games on the market. And now, from the Game On Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, here are Cody Jones and John Richard.
Well, howdy gamers. It is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. We're a podcast about all sorts of tabletop games, board games, card games, and role-playing games, with the occasional miniatures game.
Occasional.
Coming to you from the soggy and wet gaming capital of the world, Indianapolis, Indiana.
Better than snowy and icy?
Maybe.
Yes.
Okay. And we're coming to you today to talk about gaming as always. And we've got a special guest in the studio with us, and it is Jeremy DeSalinas. Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
And Jeremy is from, and I'm going to let Jeremy say exactly the name of, you know, he does these great videos on BoardGameGeek.com, and I want to make sure that we give the proper name for him. So, what exactly do you do there, Jeremy?
Well, it's called Dragon Strike's Components Breakdown Video Review Series in HD. And also I have a website called DragonStrikeVideos.com. Just put together a collection of board game videos and show them off to the public for both new gamers and new games alike.
Outstanding. And so we're so happy to have you here. We're going to be talking with Jeremy a little bit about his video reviews and how he puts those together. And we're also going to be doing a big review. Cody, what's our review?
Yeah, the new hotness released. It's Mansions of Madness from Fantasy Flight, the kind of Arkham Horror kind of meets Betrayal at House on the Hill, meets Descent hybrid, and we're going to give you everything you need to know to determine whether or not you need to buy it.
All right, but as always, we're going to start off with the rundown, and that gets started
now. All right, well, it's time for the rundown where the three of us will tell you what we've been playing. I'll start because my list is much, much shorter. I played Mansions of Madness, which we're going to talk about a little later.
Okay.
I've played twice total, and pretty interesting plays both my time. I'll get into it more in the review, but...
Were you the keeper both times?
I was the keeper. I love being the keeper.
Yeah, sure.
I do want to try as the investigator. I also got to play Cleopatra in the Society of Architects. It's kind of an old favorite, but...
Excellent game from 2006, if I remember right.
That's right, if you listen to the Dice Tower episode, sure. That was fun, as always. Played Time's Up. It was my wife's birthday, and she loves that game, so we played that. I got Flux to the table, and let me tell you, I sympathize with the Flux haters for a game.
What?
It was...
You're the biggest Looney Labs fanboy I've ever
met. I know. It was swingier than normal, which is saying something for Flux.
It was what?
Swingier.
Swingier.
I think that means back and forth.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah?
Game On with Cody and Jeremy.
So. Sweet.
That's right. And then...
I'll just step out. Thanks.
Well, you know, one I had forgotten about was Innovation. Uh-huh. You know, we talked that game up when it came out, and it just kind of collected dust on the shelf. We played a few games of it. My father-in-law picked up the new edition in the box that's about half the size, and, you know, same crappy graphic design on it, but still a really good game.
They never called you, huh? You put the call out saying that you'd redo the graphic design.
I still may do it just as a project, because that game is ugly as sin. But a really fun game. I'm still really bad at it, but I can appreciate the mechanics of it, and it's a really good two-player game. So it was nice to get that to the table again.
Jeremy, have you played Innovation?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think about that?
I like it a lot.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I like the splaying mechanic in that one. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I need to figure out a strategy, because I'm usually... decent at games, but man, I just get slaughtered every
time. Well, it's
time
like the people on Board Game Geek who just said it's just like Flux. Like they had that whole discussion.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about it.
It's nothing like Flux.
Yeah, it has cards.
Yeah.
And bad artwork.
Right.
That's all I've got, but you guys have been gaming all around town, so I'll let you get at it.
Yeah, Jeremy and I were actually did some gaming in the same place, although you know
twice.
Yeah, but we didn't play any actual games together,
did we? No, I don't think we did. No.
Yeah. But one was at our Game On Game Night, which we had the second one of those. When was that? The 1st of March?
Yes.
Yeah.
You were there.
I was there, yeah. And had another great turnout. We had 20 people show up, had 22 the first time, and 20 people showed up. And I had ahead of time sort of figured out that I wanted to try to get Merchants and Marauders to the table. And so I brought that one, and actually Greg Thomas also brought a copy, and we ended up having two simultaneous games of Merchants and Marauders going on. My game took a little longer, and never actually finished.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but we had three new players besides me, and so there was a lot of kind of rules teaching, and you know, there's a lot to take in that first time.
Was anyone going the merchant route? Easy mode?
Yes, actually, Randy went the merchant route, and I think one other player I think was also going the merchant route, and Randy ended up being a friend of the show, Randy Porter, mm-hmm. Ended up being would have been the eventual victor, probably.
So. Now I think Jeremy would agree with me on this, that as much as they say it's balanced between the merchants and the pirates, I'm still not seeing it.
No, it's not a balanced game at all. And I think I made that point on our on the Geek List when Sean brought that up, and the designer, Christian, got back with me. And he tends to think that the pirates are more powerful, but in every game that I've ever played, it's not been that way at all. No. The merchants almost always win right from the get-go.
Yeah. Yeah, if someone's able to keep a fixed merchant strategy and aren't being screwed with by the other players, I think that's the only thing that might divert that, is if you get, you know, someone coming in attacking.
You have to be extremely lucky with your dice at the start of the game as a pirate.
Yeah,
yeah, and I'm thinking, you know, they say, oh, if you're a pirate, just harass the merchant players, but the pirate's got enough to do on his own. But, yeah, instead of going out and messing with the other players.
Yeah, well, the pirate has a lot of obstacles that they have to
overcome. Apparently has to get all of these ship upgrades, you know, that's going to take some time, and he doesn't want to fall behind. So, I don't know. I think it's going to be an expansion fix that they don't necessarily want to say just yet.
See, I tried going the merchant route, and then I figured I'm going to go pirate because I need to get some money, right? I figured that would sort of accelerate things because I could get more gold. And then I had the worst dice luck ever, and, you know, my ship sank. And then I got a new ship, and then one of the other merchant players that ended up attacking me.
Oh, nice!
And sunk my ship again, and so I think I went through at least two ships, and it was brutal. So, but Jeremy, you were playing in the other game, right?
Yeah, I was, and I went merchant right off the bat, and I was playing with two other experienced players and one who had read through the rules. We actually got through our game in like 2.5 hours. It's a fairly quick game for us.
Wow, yeah, four that's pretty players. Good. Yeah, you got a second game in on that night too, right?
I don't remember if I did or not.
I think it was Puzzle Strike.
If it I was Puzzle it over, Strike. Good, looking over good the memory.
Yeah. So you probably got a second game in and won it, because I've been checking the geek list, and it's just like, Jeremy wins. I'm like, wow.
Yeah, I've seen that trend in our game night. So
yeah, the game on championship lately. Belt.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be nice. Oh, we should probably put that together. Yeah. Anyway, so I played that at the game night, but also have been able to play a few other things. One is we received a copy of a great new game from Out of the Box Publishing called Shake and Take. And okay, so the theme of the game is very strange.
It's a very complex strategy heavy Euro game. It'll take about 3 to 4 hours.
Negative. Like all Out of the Box games, right? No, this is another nice light party / family game from Out of the Box, and that's one of the reasons why we really like talking about Out of the Box games, is because they I think they can always be counted on to be some really good light fun to bring out for your family. And so this game is, the loose theme of the game is that you're trying to capture aliens, which basically means you're taking a Sharpie marker. I'm using air quotes right now. You can't see them, but a Sharpie marker to draw a circle around the aliens.
Why did circle have a quote?
I don't know.
It's a legitimate circle.
Well, you haven't played with my 4-year-old daughter. No, and that doesn't really fall into the circle category there. But so you have these little dry erase boards in front of you, and they have all these different little aliens that are loosely shaped like those like the shapes of squares, triangles, and hearts, and things like that. Then on the other side, the shapes were actual just shapes. So it's good for younger kids who aren't going to be able to figure out that little alien is actually a square. They can actually see squares. And so what you do on your turn in the game is everybody gets one of these, and the object of the game is to get all of your aliens captured or circled. And so the first person who's the alien hunter is going to start off with this dry erase marker, and we'll say go, and then they'll roll a die, and the die will have one of those shapes on it. And then they have to, as quickly as possible, circle as many of those on their card as possible of that shape. At the same time, the person who is sitting to that player's right has this little plastic egg with a die inside of it. And on one is a six-sided die. And on one side of the six-sided die, there's a picture of like a little alien head. And so they're going to start shaking this egg, shake, 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 and trying to get the alien head to come up on the die. And as soon as the alien head comes up on the die, they are supposed to snatch the marker out of the other player's hand as quickly as possible.
And then it gets violent. Turn. It gets real violent.
And they did a really good job with the components, because the dry, it's not like a regular dry erase marker. It's actually like, it's this really big, like, probably 6 or 7 inch long sort of rubber cover for a dry erase marker. So when dry erase marker dries out, you can put another one in there. And it's got a big bulbous alien head on the end of it. So
it, you know, it can take some abuse.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it makes it nice and big and an easy target for grabbing. And so then it'll pass to the right, and that person will roll the die and begin, and then the person to the right of them will start shaking the egg. And so it just keeps going around until a player wins. It gets even cooler when you have, the game is for 2 to 10 players. And when you play with 2 to 5 players, you just use one of these eggs and one marker. When you play with 6 to 10 players, you use 2 eggs and 2 markers. And so they're both going around at the same time. And you might actually end up with a situation where you're shaking the egg and circling at the same time because the eggs have kind of caught up with one another. And the rules just basically say that you can choose to shake the egg, you can choose to circle, or you could try to do both at the same time if you want to. So just kind of some crazy fun. And I played this with my wife and my mom and my 2 little kids, and all of us had a really good time. And with small kids, you can sort of slow the game down, and you don't have to be as...
Why would you want to do that? I mean, mercilessly defeat them.
My 4-year-old certainly didn't slow it down for me, because she was shaking that egg, and all of a sudden, violent, pulling it out of my hand. So a lot of fun, a good light party game. So enjoyed that one. Playing a few games at work. Not too many, but about once a week I'm able to get a game in with my buddy Pete.
Excellent.
And so we played a 2-player game of Haggis, which was an awful lot of fun. And I didn't know this about my buddy Pete, that he's apparently a veteran of trick-taking card games. And so he latched onto this one really well and basically beat the pants off of me. So,
for shame.
Oh, what can I say? It was a good time, though. And I guess all of the other games that I played were pretty much at this great event that I went to for the very first time called IndieCon. Now, Jeremy, you've been to IndieCon before, right?
This was my first year.
Oh, it was.
This was my first year. Right?
But you seem to know a lot of the folks that are involved in IndieCon. So do you think you can tell us a little bit about the convention and sort of what it's about?
Sure. It's run by a gentleman named Dave Cook. This is the fourth year that they've ran this. Dave is a veteran of gaming. He's been into PC gaming for years. Developed several games several years ago that I'm sure many people are familiar with. And when he moved here to Indy, he got together with a group called the Indianapolis Board Gamers Group. And they came together, him and Adam Dalton, to make this IndieCon. And it's a small invitational with about 100 or less people that are invited. So they try to keep it small for the fact that they don't want a lot of young children in there, and they don't want a lot of people that they don't know. It's a very small, close-knit group. And then those people are allowed to invite their friends to come as well. And we keep it at 100 people. So it's very small, runs very well, and it's just a great, great time.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, and I'm sorry Cody wasn't able to make it. He was up visiting family that weekend, but it really felt to me like Board Game Geek Con divided by 10.
That's great,
divided by 10 or 15, because it still had a great game library, which really consisted of, near as I could tell, it was just the library of people's collections.
People just brought their games with them. Yeah, everyone brought their own stuff with them.
Oh, very cool.
And they rented all these great big shelves that you just put stickers with your initials on them and just threw your game up there on the shelf, and it was there for everybody to play.
That's a good thing about having like that close-knit group, is that there's some level of trust, because everyone there is at the very least a friend of a friend of a friend,
Yeah.
Exactly.
But no small kids, because they will kick you out.
No, that's just kidding. I'm all for that.
Yeah. So some of the things that I played when I was at IndieCon, I was kind of run through them because it was a lot of games, but I got to play the old version of Automobile. And when I say old, it's not that old of a game to begin with, but a new version just came out from Mayfair Games that has some different sort of components and artwork in it. But this is a really tight Euro-style sort of economic game about manufacturing and selling automobiles. And a game that has just a very few number of decisions that you have to make in the game, so they're very, very important. And the profit margin is really small, so you start off with $2,000 in the game, and by the middle of the game, all the players I was playing with were saying, wow, if we can get to the end of this game and have our $2,000 back, then we all win. So there's not very much margin in the game. But I really did enjoy that one. I think most of the folks I played with weren't huge fans of it. And I think it was just a little bit too thinky for them. That's one you played too, right, Jeremy?
I've played it before. I'm not a big fan of Automobile.
Okay.
Not one of my favorite Martin Wallace games out there, for sure.
Yeah, it was definitely a little bit of a brain burner. I would like to try it with you, Cody, to see what you think of it.
Oh boy. Where do I sign?
I'm leading you farther and farther into the pool of Eurogames.
I don't know about that.
I just want to see at what point you lose your footing and drown. So, I played some Dominion, played Lords of Vegas, got a great game in of that where I almost came to blows with two of the players. There was I don't even know what was going on. It was a three-player game, and it was the other
two
players.
You're joking, right?
I'm not joking.
Oh,
no.
Good.
It was three players in the game, and...
Friend of a friend.
And I wasn't involved at all, but it just seemed like the other two, I was in the lead. And so these two were kind of working out some sort of deal to catch up and overtake me. And so one of the players let the other guy take a tile or something like that, or they traded properties. And then apparently there was no reciprocation of that deal, and there were some words.
Oh, so you weren't about to come to blows with someone.
Oh, no, no, no.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
No. Well, look at me. I'm not going to... No.
That's what I was asking.
But no, I had to sit there and kind of watch this very sort of awkward conversation between these two guys. But it worked out okay. And I think I ended up losing. So it wasn't even like it was...
Was this your first time playing?
No, no. I brought the game with me.
Okay,
actually.
So it's your game.
Times.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you miss the poker chips?
I brought my poker chips.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, we played with poker chips because... Yeah, the paper money in that game.
No. Paper good, money in any game.
Yeah. Let's see. I got to play Glenmore, which have we talked about that one before?
No, it's one I've put on GameShare.
Okay.
But I never got a chance to play it, really.
Yeah, a really interesting little game that has sort of a rondel mechanic, a little bit. It's sort of, you know, where you only have certain actions and tiles that you can choose, and it's sort of a rotating thing on this little board. But you're building a little tile structure of... Scottish things, I guess, and distilleries.
It's your clan's territory, sir.
Oh, sure, okay. Yeah, these little.
Glenmore was my first Dragon Strike video, so.
Oh, wow.
Oh, really?
The, yeah.
Oh, because that's how.
Because I had this box, I'm like, hmm.
Oh, very good.
I'm like,
good.
I like Scottish stuff, but
I'm not sure if we could call wheat and sheep and cattle Scottish.
Not exclusively Scottish, right?
Okay.
Whiskey, maybe.
Yeah, there you go.
Or Irish, right?
There you go.
I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Oh, Scotch whiskey, right? Yeah, I'm not a drinker, sorry. But yeah, so I got to taught that game by, well, Jeremy actually helped to teach it, but Stephen Conway from The Spiel. I got to sit down with him and his right-hand lady, Francie, and another listener of our show, Brendan, and really enjoyed that one. That was, and I think I won, which is surprising.
Yeah, that doesn't happen a lot.
I don't win too many games, but I enjoyed that one. Played some Fresco on Saturday, and that's a good game. Oh, and I played Fresco with the expansion for the first time, which I've had Fresco for a while, and I've played it probably half a dozen times, but I'm always playing with new people, and so I never want to pull out the expansion with something that's brand new. But with this game, it actually makes sense to use the expansion. It doesn't really add that much complexity to it, and it gives a little bit more variety to the game, I think. So I enjoyed that one, and I lost that one by 2 points, and because at the very last, sorry, I just got to tell this quick story.
Stories are awesome.
Oh, I know, people love this. You know, you at the end of the at the beginning of the turn, you decide what time you're going to get up, and that determines the mood of your painters. And so I happened to, as a sort of a last ditch effort to get some final points, I decided to get up really early in the morning, which caused my little mood track to slip one space below where it needed to be, where I actually ended up losing one of my guys. Mm. And so I had one less action to do. And so it ended up working out that if I had that one meeple, I would have been able to have gotten just like a couple more coins, which would have taken me over. No, I would have gotten three more coins, which would have taken me two more victory points up, and I actually would have won the game. So it was just that one little meeple just ruined the whole thing. Wasn't that exciting?
That was. You know, games about painting are really exciting.
that's,
I'm sorry.
That's enough out of you.
It was a fine game.
Okay. Lots more games at IndieCon. Played Blue Moon City, which I hadn't gotten to the table in quite a long time. Played a great two-player game of that with Jerry, and I think he enjoyed that as well. Played in a Teach You tournament. Played poorly.
Mm, I wasn't there.
No. I played very poorly, but it was fun to play in that. A little single elimination tournament. Played London with the two guys from BoardGameExchange.com.
Oh, yeah. Locally based, right?
In Columbus, Indiana, I believe. Was where
Indiana,
were
based. Yeah.
Yeah. So real nice guys, and got that one at the table. I think they hadn't played that one before. Still liking that one. It's a long list. I'm sorry.
I know. Mine was puny.
Played a game of Survive Escape from Atlantis, which is one that I just got on GameShare from Myriad Games, but haven't actually opened the box yet. But I wanted to see if I could go ahead and learn the rules and play it there. incredible components in this game. Really colorful, neat tiles.
I love the boats.
And the little boats are cool, and lots of wooden pieces. And a real simple game, and you know, a kind of a family game, I think. But you know, and I think a good family game, because it's one of those family games where, you know, you play it with your parents or your kids or your uncle or whatever, and it's got sort of that family take that thing to it. Oh, I'm going to send the shark to kill you, Uncle Joe. You know, it's got that sort of feel to it. Like, you know, the game's from 1982, I think, is when it first came out. And you can sort of imagine on the box, like, you know, little Johnny, like, pointing and you know, and laughing. You know, it's got that sort of feel. Great game. Really recommend that one. Okay, finishing up here, I played a game of Seven Wonders. As usual, I had to teach that game, and I still have not played a game of Seven Wonders where I didn't have to teach like six people how to play. So
I'm getting a copy of the second printing.
Are you?
Yeah. So we'll get to the table more. Even though my wife hates it. So
I got to say it again. I'm still amazed that you went from Seven Wonders hater to now having the micro badge that says Seven Wonders fan.
Big fan.
On your avatar. Oh, wow. On Board Game Geek. That's a big swing.
That's like going steady. You know, that's a big deal.
I don't think I've met anybody that hates Seven Wonders yet.
Yeah, well, Kaylin should be home pretty soon.
That's right. Yeah.
You can talk to her.
No, she even says, I don't hate it. It's just not my favorite. She doesn't like it.
Okay, yeah. But no, that's a good one. And the very last thing that I did was I played in a Wits and Wagers tournament that Adam Dalton put together. And mm-hmm. It was really funny because it was very loose Wits and Wagers rules. Like, he just basically threw up dry erase board and said, we'll just put some stuff up here and you guys got to keep track of your own score, and I'm just going to give you the answer and then you tell me how many points you bet and what your score was. So it was, you know, a lot of trust, like you said, in the IndyCon attendees there. But it was cool because he had 10 questions and half of them were about board gaming and the other half were about just Indianapolis with some sort of gaming twinge to it. So you're being an indie person, Cody, and having not been an IndyCon, I'll ask you a couple of these questions. Okay.
Right? Okay.
All right. So how many, let's see, how did he phrase it? How many years has Gen Con been not in Indy?
I would say 30.
No help from Jeremy over here.
32.
36.
That was close.
That was really close. And the other one, the very last.
It's not about Indy at all. It's about Milwaukee.
Good point. But the other question was, the very final question was, how many days elapsed between the demolition of the Market Square Arena mm-hmm. and the demolition of the RCA Dome?
How many days?
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, I don't even remember the exact
number. Like 3,500?
It was more than that, I think, because it ended up being, I think, like 9 years. So whatever, 9 times 300 and blah, 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 blah. And so
that's close.
You were close, yeah. No, you
I win!
Hey. Anyway, my team ended up winning by 2 points, and the prize was great. The folks at North Star Games donated a case of 4 copies of Wits and Wagers Family, so I picked up a copy of that. So to get that one to the table soon. All right, I'm done. I've been talking for like 3 hours.
Take a break.
Jeremy, what did you play at IndyCon?
We have a guest.
I'm sorry.
I've played a lot of games lately, obviously, because I do all the video reviews, but I played Mansions of Madness for about 2 weeks straight.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, well, just to put up the first part of my review, because I had to break it up, I played it 6 times prior to doing the review. And I've played it 2 cents, just because it takes a lot of time to set up and break back down. So that's one of the games. Right now I'm working on the Trollhalla. I'm not sure if you guys have heard of that game.
Oh, yeah, it's the Alf Siegert game?
Yeah, right? Exactly. It's a light worker placement, set collection style game. So I've been playing a lot of that with my wife, 2-player. And we had some friends over the other night and played it 3- and 4-player just so I got all the aspects down. So that should be up this week. At game night that we've been going to, like you said, played Merchants and Marauders. Got a chance to play that. Another runaway victory. I mean, I think it was 10-5, 4-3.
Wow. And did you say you went a merchant?
Yeah, I went a merchant right from the start. Wow, so, okay. I mean, that's going to happen, though. I mean, I don't think I've ever played a game where the Pirates have won.
I've not.
Ever.
But the Pirates have fun, right?
Yeah, they have fun. In last place.
In last place,
exactly. And at IndyCon, I think one of the big hits there was Terroir, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right. You know, when I did my breakdown, I did the whole Google search where you go and you have to find the pronunciation to make sure you say it right. So I think it's Terroir, but
here in Indiana,
gonna say
we call it Troyes.
Troyes.
Is that a Troyes game?
Exactly. That was a huge hit. I brought my copy there, and no one had really had a chance to play yet because it's not out here yet. I think Z-Man's bringing that over here.
Yeah, pretty soon.
In
I think.
April, yeah. For those that are not aware, it's kind of a worker placement with dice allocation. A lot of people compare it to like Kingsburg, where you roll dice, or maybe Alien Frontiers, mm-hmm. where you roll your dice and then you use those to do particular events on the board. The unique thing about the game is that you can actually buy dice from your opponents, and they can't stop you from doing it. So there's a lot of, you know, take that in the game or screw it, as most people say. So I got a chance to play that almost six times when I was there. My just goodness. Love that game.
Yeah, you played it six times at IndieCon?
Yeah, at IndieCon.
Oh, wow. Because wow. Because I saw it being played. I don't think I saw you at the table one time, so it must have gotten played a ton.
Well, I taught it, too, as well. Oh, yeah, I mean, you look at all the geek lists out there, and everyone's played it at least once.
That's cool.
We finally had a chance for myself and Adam to sit down and play a game of Civilization. You guys played that one yet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm actually running a game of that. Well, by the time this episode's released, I will have already done that, but at HoosierCon this coming weekend, yeah.
It was great. It's this was I've played it prior, obviously, but we had a four-player game going, and it ended epically, like almost all the games do. I won at the very end of the game with a cultural victory. The guy right to my left, Andrew, would have won on the same turn with a money victory, and I nuked him at the same time. It was just injury to insult. It was beautiful.
Nice. That was how our most recent game of that went. I think I won on an economic victory, but if it had gotten around to Cody, he would have won on his cultural.
Yep. Yeah, they all seem to work like that. They're one or two turns from one person winning.
That's great, I think.
Played London, obviously. Taught that quite a few times. Played Glenmore several times. K2, another one I'm not sure if you guys have heard of.
Saw that being played, but
yeah, it's only out overseas right now in Europe primarily, and I don't know if it even has a distributor or publisher here in the U.S., but it's basically a mountain climbing game. It's kind of a push-your-luck style game. Everyone starts off with the same deck of cards to use. It just matters when those cards up, and they allow you to move or acclimatize your lungs to be able to hold air. And it's basically a race up to the top, and then once you get up to the top, you try to stay up there without dying because people can die and be ejected from the game. So I got to play that several times. I got to teach it.
Would you say that's the best game with an acclimatizing your lungs mechanic?
I think that's the only one, isn't it?
Okay, well, then there you go.
I like saying ejection because, you know, if it's like an umpire standing there, it's like, you're gone!
Ejection!
Got to play Nightfall.
Yeah.
The new deck building game by AEG. Got to teach that to a couple new people. Gosu, which is a two-player deck building game. It's kind of like a deck building game, but not really. It's kind of hard to explain. Maybe some elements of Magic the Gathering mixed in. Dungeon Lords. I got to play Raw for the first time, which is very surprising since I've been doing this for like 3 years now and I've never played Raw.
I've actually never played that myself.
It's amazing that you go back and you see all these old games. Another one I got to play was Elfinlands, which I absolutely hated. I think I had a headache and it was late Saturday night at 11 o'clock. And you know, from Saturday, it was so loud in there just from all the people in such a small room. But by the time we got to play that, I mean, I almost passed out from playing it. Was so bad. Have you guys ever played Elfinlands?
I've played it once. I didn't.
Wasn't
care
that
for
a Spiel des Jahres winner?
Yeah, and I don't know how won that.
I mean,
that must have been a terrible year for games because game is not fun at all.
Okay,
didn't Niagara win the Spiel des Jahres?
They
did.
See, that's what I'm saying.
That's a good point. Thurn of Taxes also won. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, preach it, baby.
Make an argument for you.
Another old one was Downfall of Pompeii.
Okay.
Got to play Lahav, and then I think the big one that I was waiting to play was Dominant Species. You know, I've heard some really good things about that from some other like reviewers who have rated it like their number one game last year. Yeah. And, you know, in 2010, and I played it, and it just did not sit well with me at all. The problem I had with the game is that on the right hand side of the board, you have all these actions that you use your tokens to be able to do. And about half of them are good, and the other half are just terrible. They have no point of being in the game. And then everyone goes for the same type of actions, and that's scoring points. And when you score points and you have the most dominant species in an area, you get these cards. And these cards are extremely overpowered. So we actually had someone at the end of their first turn literally lose all of their tokens and all of their dominance tokens from the game. So they basically spent the rest of the game trying to catch up. So you have, number one, you have almost complete elimination from the game. And there's no kind of catch-up mechanism. And then you have a runaway leader problem with it. Now, maybe it was just, and the people that I've talked to said maybe it was just a bad game for you in particular, but it just didn't sit well with me at all. Now, I like the mechanics of the game, and I think it makes sense. And for people that like really heavy games with lots of different decisions, this is definitely your style of game, but just didn't sit well with me at all. Wow, I don't know.
I have a hard time with those games that have that much of a not a learning curve, but a getting good at curve, you know, where I guess it's because I don't get that games to the table that many times. A lot of, you know, so I want to be able to have a chance within the first time or second time that I play it, you know?
You don't want to be punished for being new. I mean, obviously, right. experience is going to help, but you don't want to get crushed every time just right. because you're a new player.
Well, sure. we were all new players, all six of us that were playing. And I think that's
you
one of the...
six-player game with all new players. Game.
And it went pretty well. I mean, okay. it went fast. I think we played it in like 2.5-3 hours.
Nice.
But I think that's one of those games where you have to sit down and play it with experienced players that teach you mm-hmm. how to play and what the best actions. The guy actually teaching it, his name is Jack, real nice gentleman there. He knew how to play it, but this was his first time as well. So we all didn't know exactly what we were doing throughout the entire game.
Okay, well, that's interesting. That's
kind of reminds me of Through the Ages in that that's a really hard game to learn with all new players. You know, you almost need that mentor there to say, okay, this is what you want to do, you know?
Yeah, that's one that as time goes by and we haven't played it, it's like my memory of the rules is fading slowly, and I'm concerned.
You're concerned?
I have concerns. Oh, okay. All right, well, that's about 1,000 games that have been played these last couple weeks, right?
I played five, so that's...
You did. I don't even remember what you said. It was like, it was like 3 hours like 3 ago. Mm-hmm. All right, so that's the rundown.
All right, well, we're really pleased and honored to have Jeremy DeSalinas of, what is it again? I'm not going to get tripped up.
Dragon Strikes Components Breakdown Video Review Series in HD.
We're not idiots. We know what it is. We don't want to mess it up.
That's right.
You know, I've got a lot of people that's asked me to change that name.
Really?
Yeah, and I probably should because I can't even say it sometimes. It's too long.
Take out a note card. It's
this is actually the fourth take because he got it wrong. No, I'm just kidding.
And if you've been around BoardGameGeek or been to his website, you've seen the work he's done. I think last episode we were just gushing over the Mansions of Madness, the first two parts of it that are up.
Yeah,
waiting for that third part. I've seen the pictures of the painted miniatures. Really good stuff.
Oh,
that was a tease.
Outstanding.
So we want to welcome Jeremy, and we want to, I guess, start off, what is your gaming background? How did you get into this hobby?
Give us the resume.
All right. Well, like most people, I started video gaming when I was about six. Started off with the Commodore 64 and Atari and everything else. And I've been into gaming my whole life, D&D, board games here and there. But it was really video games that caught me. And then after college, I went to DePaul University out in Greencastle. I started working for a video game company and doing product distribution for them. And worked with them for 6 years. And through that course of going through conventions and whatnot, I started getting back into board gaming. And then it wasn't until about 4 or 5 years ago that I really got into the Euro games, what people call enthusiast games. You get away from the old stuff and into the more Euro-style games. And ever since then, I mean, I've always gone to Gen Con. I've been going to Gen Con back when I was in Milwaukee. This will be my 11th year that I've gone straight. So I've always gone, but I haven't gone for board games particularly. I was more into the Star Wars CCG, the Lord of the Rings CCG, and those type of even Magic prior to that. And it wasn't until about 3 or 4 years ago that I started getting back into board gaming.
Hmm.
So that's really my background. More video games. I mean, I've always been into video games my entire life. Played in a lot of competitions and like I said, worked for a company.
I was going to say, I noticed that your gamer score for your game is ridiculously high. I mean,
Well, in the official Xbox magazine back about 2 years after the Xbox came out, the 360 came out, I was the number 3 ranked person in the world on GamerScore.
Wow.
So I have an article in there written, but that was a long time ago. Yeah. And, you know, trying to keep up with that kind of stuff is nearly impossible. It's almost like a second job.
Sure. Yeah. And you've got a first job.
And now I have another second job, which is these videos. So.
Yeah. So talk to us a little bit about these videos. You know, we've talked in previous episodes of the show just how fantastic we think they are. And you've only been doing this for less than a year, is that right?
About 6 months.
Okay, so maybe just walk us through the process of how you decided to start doing that and just sort of the process of that you've gone through to start doing this.
When I first started back into the board game market, I started like most people that are new to it and want to find out a lot of information on what games are out there. You look on YouTube. And you do Google searches, and you find people like Tom Vassell and Scott Nicholson, who at that time primarily had, the market on board games. And as a new gamer, you want to try to find some kind of visual element that's going to get you stimulated and give you a basic idea. And you don't always get that from a written review. I mean, you get a lot of good information, but you don't get to see all the components and see.
You don't get the excitement.
Yeah, you don't get any of that visual flair. So at Gen Con this year, getting on BoardGameGeek, you see all these people that go to these conventions and they bring these huge hauls of stuff back and they take pictures of them, you know, mm-hmm. or do a video of them and they mm-hmm. show you what you got. So I started to do that at Origins first. And I started taking pictures with my iPhone. And then at Gen Con, I took a video for Invasion from Outer Space from FFP. And that was my first video of Remain. I did the complete thing with my iPhone. And I was thinking at the time, when I originally came up with the idea that I wanted to do more of the components, that's where you get the components breakdown. I liked opening up the boxes, I liked seeing all the chits inside, all the cool plastic pieces and the boards and the beautiful artwork and those kind of things. And there wasn't a lot of that. You watched, like I said, Tom Vassell and Scott Nicholson, you got to see more of the tutorial and some basic things, but you didn't really get to see all the components that came inside. So for about the first 20 or 30 videos, that's all I did. Just opened up the box, lay out the game, show people what it looks like when it's sitting out. And then as I got more and more people interested, people were coming to me and saying, well, why don't you teach a little bit or at least give a review? Tell us what you think about the game. So at that time, I went outside. You know, I need to buy a better camera and not do this with my iPhone. So I went out to the market and bought a good HD camera, researched a little bit about some software. And I have no technical background at all with any videography at all.
Really?
None. Wow. None. I basically went out, bought software, bought a camera, and just learned on my own, which is not easy. So that's where you see the progression over the last 40, 50 videos into doing what I do now. So about the 50th video, I decided, you know, I'm going to start doing something a little bit different. Now, I grew up like most people. I'm 36 years old, so I grew up in the Star Wars era. And ever since that time, you see movie trailers, and movie trailers have always been huge to me. I was the kind of kid that'd get really upset with my parents if they didn't get me to the movie on time where I could see the trailers. I love the trailers.
Sure.
So that's what I try to mix in about the 50th or 60th video, is putting together cool music, cool introductions, and using a lot of After Effects and text to be able to bring it to a different kind of stage than what most people are familiar with board games. And the best way I can kind of explain it is, if you look at video games and you look at all the different websites, you have IGN, you have GameSpot, you have Giant Bomb, doing these beautifully rendered video reviews of games. And then you look at the board game market and they have nothing. I mean, they've got two reviewers and that's it.
Yeah.
And they really don't, they specialize in telling you about the games, but they don't really specialize in any visual flair. So I tried bringing all that together into one series where it would excite people, it would give them an idea of how the game plays, and then it would really show them what I felt about the game at the end of it. So it just took a lot of time, and right now I'm on my 95th video, and they take a huge amount of time now. When I was first doing them, they took maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours. Now they take 18 to 24 hours to do. Because what I have to do, if you guys are interested, what I initially do is I get the game, and I still buy about 75 to 80% of my game. So I go out and I buy it, and then I play it for 2 to 3 days straight with as many people as I possibly can. The least amount of playthroughs I need to play is three. The most is, I mean, I think I played 16 times for Nightfall to make sure I had everything. Hmm. And then once that gets done, I basically do an outline on paper of everything I want to say in that. And then once I get the outline done, I record the audio, just the audio, no video at all. And I walk myself through everything I want to say, lay that all on tape, and put it onto, I use Sony Vegas Pro 9, or Pro 10 right now. Once I do that, I have to go back and record all the video. And then I overlay that on top of the audio, splicing and editing it.
Do you listen to the audio while you're recording? Because you have just like a written outline in front of you?
I have a written outline of what I've done.
Okay.
So then I go back and I record it all visually and then put it on top of that. And then usually I'll contact the publisher prior to that and ask them for the title, because usually you can't find the right fonts or the right graphics, and a lot of them are custom made. So now I'm at the point where publishers will actually send me either like a PSD file or a really bad JPEG or something. So I have to go in visually and mask out that behind whatever, you know, ugly background that they have behind it to make sure that the video looks proper. Once all that is done, I have to work on the introduction. which takes 2 to 6 hours to do because there's a lot of after effects that have to be done with smoke and fire and all that kind of cool stuff. And then the post-production stuff, and that's making sure that all the everything fits together, all the title sequences fit together, all the music fits together, it's all pieced together properly. It's just a huge amount of time. And once that gets done, there has to be a rendering. And when you render in HD, it takes like 3 to 6 hours for that thing to get done. So you're sitting there at the computer making sure it doesn't crash on you or nothing else bad happens. And then you got to load it up onto YouTube, which takes another 3 to 4 hours.
Wow.
And then you have to load it up onto BoardGameGeek and then link it all, you know, to all the different websites that you're going to. So it, right now it's about 18 to 24 hours on minimum. I know the I'm not sure if you guys saw the top 10 of 2010 video that I did.
Yeah, no, I sure but did.
That took about 50 hours today.
Wow.
I mean, just a huge amount of time because you have to lay out all the boards, re-record everything, re-record all the audio. It's just an immense amount of time that it takes to do them.
And it definitely shows because, I mean, the quality is unparalleled. You said that you contact the publisher and get the title.
Mm-hmm.
What has been the I can only imagine what the answer is, but what are the publishers of these games that you've done, what has been their response?
It's really great so far because a lot of them are using them on their own website, and a lot of them are contacting me prior to games coming out. Like most people, you like to be first to the market. I mean, you want to be able to deliver a product under your own namesake that no one else has seen.
Yeah.
So what I pride myself on is trying to get the games as early as I can. And I always tell the publisher that I'll pay for everything. You know, I'll pay for it to be airlifted here to the US. I'll pay for the shipping. I'll pay for the game, whatever it takes for me to get it. And then I try to deliver a product that the designer is going to be proud of and that the publisher is going to be proud of, where they can show it on their website or show it to their friends and family and say, this is what I made, and this is what somebody spent hours doing for us. And so far, I've gotten nothing but compliments and, you know, thank yous and everything else from publishers. So it's been great so far.
It seems like the response on BoardGameGeek from BoardGameGeek users has been similar.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, do you see this as a trend that's really going to pick up? I know Fantasy Flight, at least the past year or so, they've been doing in-house videos. Do you see more game companies maybe getting an in-house studio to do it or outsourcing it? Or
well, there's a fine line that you have to walk as a reviewer between getting paid to do stuff and then doing it as an enthusiast.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I don't want to really get into too deep, for the fact that if you start getting paid for your work, then you're no longer doing it for fun. And I've always said when I started doing these reviews, people said, well, why don't you give more bad reviews? Well, I don't give more bad reviews because I have to have a vested interest to spend 24 hours on a video. It means that I have to want the game in the first place. So I've never been a reviewer that just says, send me stuff and I'll review it.
Mm-hmm.
I have to want to play the game, which means I'm probably going to like it in the first place. So kind of to answer your question, I don't know if that's going to be the trend, because this still seems like it's really in the infancy of visual media as far as board games. It's more of a social aspect and less of a huge social, you know, media type thing like video games are. And I'm not sure if it'll ever go that way, but if it does, I definitely want to be there to at least assist companies to getting the word out about new games. Absolutely.
And to do a quick kind of a Myriad teaser, one of the cool things when we were at Myriad Games is they had a few high-def TVs, small ones, but, you know, 20-some inches, hanging up, and they were just kind of looping production videos from Fantasy Flight and other companies, and that was really neat. And I think that if more game stores or hobby stores really got into that, I mean, you know, you're sitting there watching, I'm watching a Battlestar Galactica video overview, and I have that game, and I'm like, oh, wow, I really want that. Oh, I have that game. And it's it for board games, it's just not something you expect.
It's a different kind of media. When you get into video games, that's what they do. Video is what they do. When you get into board games, I don't know how many publishers have come to me and said, I don't even know where to start. I mean, I don't have a video camera. I don't even know what to do. And that's typical of most board game designers. They go out and they market it to a publisher, and then the publisher, you know, sells it. But really, you only have one company out there, being FFG, that does high-end videos.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if any other company's going to want to invest in that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
It's a weird thing, because it is sort of a fine line of enthusiasm and sort of viral marketing. What we do, even as podcasters here, is, you know, we sit and we talk about games that we like. because we like them, you know, not because the publisher has said, hey, you know, Cody and John, you need to talk about this game, you know. It's because we'll talk about something that we like because we do want other people who hear us talk about what we like. We want them to try it too. Not because we work for a publisher, but because we just want to share what, you know, things that we like. And it sounds like that's what you're doing as well. But it does get into a sort of a fine line of it still is marketing, you know, even if the aim of it isn't, you know, we're not being driven by the publisher, it's still a form of marketing. And it's, you know, it seems like something that could very easily cross into that,
that territory. And it's relatively free marketing too to them. I mean, they don't have to pay anything but shipping and the game cost itself to get to people like myself who spend, you know, a large amount of time doing these video reviews.
Yeah. Now, you said that you didn't have a background in video before you started this, but it seems like just watching your progression in 6 months has been pretty amazing. Do you have any other video projects beyond this that you would be considering? Or you know, now that you've got these skills?
Not really, no. I mean, like I said, this is just something fun that I do. And I don't ever want it to be anything more than that, at least at this point. Maybe in the future down the road, but right now I just have fun getting the new games. Like anybody else, you like to try the newest stuff. And being able to do this allows me to get the newest stuff and to spread out that word to people as well. So monetizing it, maybe in the future, but it's more or less just a hobby and what I enjoy doing. And it's great that it's come over so well to publishers and designers, but you know, the fans as well. I mean, it's just a huge amount of people that have watched these now. I think I've had these up for 6 months on YouTube and I already have 250,000 views and over 1,000 subscribers. And I think that's pretty phenomenal for just a small board game niche that really isn't a huge market like video games.
Yeah, a lot of thumbs being thrown around on BGG.
I've never seen so many thumbs on a particular post or video.
Now, you said you have just done or you're getting ready to do 95. Do you have plans for your 100th video? Anything special?
It's great that you asked that. There is a game that is, I've asked a publisher if they could airmail it from China to me. I can't really divulge that right now because there's some timing issues. I have my 96th one coming out probably later tonight or tomorrow. I've got the Mansions of Madness Part 3. I've got two smaller games, so that leaves me with 100th, which says probably the beginning of April is when I'm going to be filming it. And I've already contacted a couple publishers. I've gotten good feedback, and both of them have said, if we can be a part of it, we're going to airmail it to you and get it to you, but I can't tell you the title right now.
I'm looking forward to Candyland, personally.
Super Mario Brothers Monopoly, actually. That's right. I'm hoping that one
It'll be a big one. It'll be a big one, definitely. Whether it passes Mansions of Madness, though, I don't know. That was like the perfect storm. It was the number one most anticipated game of 2011, and then no one else really had it, and I just got it out at the perfect time. So.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing stuff. I mean, we would just encourage everybody to check out on Board Game Geek, on YouTube, and also at DrakenStrikeVideos.com. And that's DrakenStrike, DrakenStrikeVideos.com.
That is correct.
And so, Jeremy, thank you so much for being with us.
Absolutely. And,
Stay with us because we're going to be talking about one of the games you mentioned there, Mansions of Madness, coming up. So stay tuned.
Great. Thanks, guys.
I tried to turn it off. But guess what I saw? Video in the home. A video telephone. A video in the car. I think I'm going video.
All right, hey, you know what? I forgot. We haven't done an interview in quite a while.
No, it's been too long.
That's right. And so, Jeremy, before we move on to Mansions of Madness, we have to do what's become a tradition here on Game On with Cody and John, and that is to subject you to the final five.
I'm ready.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
He's ready.
He's confident. The others have been shaky.
All right. Do you remember the final five, Cody? Do you remember the first question?
Of course.
Go ahead.
What is your favorite game?
Of all time.
There's a dramatic
pause. Of all time.
Of all time.
Of all time.
Yes.
Wow. That's a great question. Probably War of the Ring Collector's Edition. I'm a huge fan of War of the Ring, period. And when they came out with the Collector's Edition, it was just...
You're just flaunting it. Now, Jeremy's been so kind as to give us each a copy of War of the Ring Collector's Edition. We thank you so much for that.
You're
and
welcome.
For each of our listeners, we'll be sending out a copy of War of the Ring Collector's Edition. Okay, number two. What is your least favorite game and the game that you would never, ever make a video about, ever, ever?
Probably Elfenland, since it's the most it's the most recent game that I've played that just left a horrible taste in my mouth. I don't even want to talk about it. It was so bad.
Well, when you said it, almost made you pass out.
Yeah, it was terrible.
He's looking green right
Elfenland,
now.
Elfenland, definitely.
Okay, Elfenland. Wow, that was strong. All right, number three. What is your what is the best thing about playing games, in your opinion? What's the best thing about playing
games?
Well,
the great thing about board games compared to video games is the social aspect. Having friends over in the same room and being able to socialize about everything besides just the game itself. So definitely socialization. Absolutely.
Okay, awesome. Number four.
All right, if you had to play one game to the exclusion of all others, what game would that be?
For the rest of your life.
The rest of my life? Oh my goodness. You guys are hard. You know what? If Mansions of Madness actually had, I'm glad we're getting into this, but if it actually had like 500 scenarios, I could live with that forever.
Good man.
So you basically want Mansions of Madness and Corey Kanisko on a leash, you know, like in your
absolutely.
House.
Absolutely. I love themed games.
You have to let him graze.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, very good. And number five, the final question in the final five, Monopoly, great board game or greatest board game?
That's such a trick question.
Answer the question, Jeremy.
It's not the greatest, so it's got to be great, right?
I will take that. Yes, I believe that is a great board game. Okay, very good. All right, Jeremy, thanks so much. That is the final five. Let's move on to Mansions of Madness.
All right, it's time to get into Buy, Try, or Deny, but before we do that, we'd like to give our due penance to our great sponsor, Myriad Games, who sponsors us on behalf of friendly professional gaming stores everywhere.
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 Not just in New Hampshire, where he's located, but everywhere.
Right. Live free or die.
Yep.
Something we want to thank Myriad Games and Game Salute for is they actually got us a preview copy of Mansions of Madness so we could review it for you fine people. It's released as you're listening to this, but not for long. We were able to get it. Really play through it and get a good look at it and watching the Drakenstrike video of it. It was nice of him to give us the preview copy, so we give a tip of the cap to Myriad Games.
Thanks.
All right.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Myriad Games.
And now it's time for the guy who does your favorite reviews. It's John Richard.
All right. So Mansions of Madness is the extreme new hotness. It's like the newest, hottest hotness. It's like boiling hot hotness. And
you're saying it's hot?
No.
Okay.
No. Anyway, it's from Corey Konietzka and Fantasy Flight Games. Corey is the designer of many great games from Fantasy Flight, including Cody's favorite, Battlestar Galactica, mm-hmm.
And Rune Wars.
And Rune Wars as well. Yeah, that guy. What else has he designed?
You put me on the spot.
As I looked at Jeremy.
Jeremy's asleep over there.
It usually takes about 15 minutes.
He was settling in for a John Rules rundown.
It usually takes 15 minutes before you fall asleep. No, yeah, anyways, he's designed a whole lot of great stuff for Fantasy Flight. And, you know, I just an aside before we start on that, I think it's real interesting that Fantasy Flight has, like, in-house designers. Like, it sort of feels to me like, you know, Hollywood of yesteryear, where you'd have, you know...
The MGM stars.
Yeah, and, yeah. He signed for a four-picture deal, you know? And it just sort of seems like these guys are on retainer, you know?
Well, it's the bullpen. You're like, Kevin Wilson, bring him out.
Yeah, yeah. It's like you're never going to hear, like, you know, Martin Wallace signs on at Fantasy Flight and goes and gets a cubicle in Minnesota and starts designing games.
Can you imagine that game, the Martin Wallace designed game that Fantasy Flight produces?
It'd have poverty in it, I'm sure.
It would.
But the poverty would be like rotting skulls. And, you know, it'd be great.
And a really, really big, scary font. You know?
I still want to see London produced by Fantasy Flight Games. It'd be the best thing.
I think it'd be great. Yeah. Fire and death, yeah. Anyway, so that was just an aside there. Mansions of Madness, released this year by Fantasy Flight Games, retails for $80, but the reason why is you're going to get a box full of fun and plastic as well and cardboard. And this is a game that we've mentioned it before. It's a good way of describing it. It sort of takes Betrayal at House on the Hill, Arkham Horror, and Descent, throws it into a big pot, stirs it up, and you get this whole different sort of experience here. And it's a game of, as the box says, exploration, mystery, and horror, for 2 to 5 players. It has the same sort of feel as Descent in that you're going to have many players versus one. You have one player who plays, in this case, called the Keeper, sort of like the Overlord, more or less. And they're going to be running this mansion and all of the bad guys that are in the mansion. And then you're going to have investigators that are going to be entering this house and are going to be trying to find clues to determine sort of the outcome of a story. This game has a very different feel from Descent in that Descent is a game about going into the dungeon and killing stuff and taking treasure.
There's a loose quest usually, but it just involves killing a big guy most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, you can avoid things in the dungeon if you want to, but most of the time it's going to be all about rolling those dice to kill stuff. This game, I think, has a very different feel in that you are going to encounter monsters and you may have to fight them, but that's not really the main aim of the game. So, Cody has played as the Keeper before. So, can you just sort of give us an idea? We're not going to go through, just to tell you up front, we're not going to go through a big rules overview of this game. There's a lot of rules in the game, but I think the basic structure of how things work is pretty simple. And so we're just going to sort of give you a feel for that and a flavor for the game, then give you our opinions on it. And I think that plus Dragon Strike's great video will give you all that you need to know about this game. So we're basically using Jeremy to do less work, right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's the game on way.
Checks in the mail, Jeremy. All right, so Cody, when we played our game, you played as the Keeper. And mm-hmm. So what kind of things are involved when you're setting up the as the Keeper?
Well, this game has a substantial setup time, even when you're familiar with it. Now, Jeremy, you've played more than I have. Would you say even with increased plays, it's still a good time commitment to set up?
Yeah, you're talking probably 15 to 20 minutes to set up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But what's neat is there's a separate Keeper's Guide where you're going to pick the scenario, and then from there are branching story options. So there are 5 stories, but there's usually 3 kind of sub-stories, if you want to call them that. So you essentially get about 15 scenarios that are based within 5 kind of larger sets, if that 5 makes sense.
5 maps, right?
Yeah. And so you'll kind of choose the story. You'll choose kind of certain elements. You know what happened to make this mystery happen. You know, where is this special item? Where is so and so buried, et cetera, et cetera. So you'll set all that up, and then what's neat is you'll build the game's decks of cards, just kind of based around that. So you're not always playing with. You're not just taking all of the, you know, exploration cards and just kind of putting them on the table. It's very deliberate. You're picking which card you're going to use, and the book will tell you where to seed the cards in the house. And it's just very deliberate, and you put it in a very special order. And then once you have that set up, you're good to go. And so a lot like Descent, a Keeper turn, not to get too much into it, you know, there's Gathering Threat, and it's played just the same as Descent, you know, based on number of players. You know, you'll have, they call them Mythos cards, but you'll have kind of Keeper cards that let you do things. What's neat is that depending on the scenario, you'll have a hand of cards that are always there. So you kind of have, you always have something in your hand, you know, just bread and butter stuff, you know, moving the monsters, you know, kind of doing little things to investigators, things like that. So it feels a lot like Descent, but you have a little more control because you always have at least these stock options to go back to.
But every turn you're getting that threat, which is kind of like your money, right?
That's right, yeah. You have this currency, which lets you do bad things to the investigators. There's also cards called trauma cards, which I thought were really neat, that you can play on investigators when they take physical or mental damage, and it just twists the knife a little bit. It's like, oh, you took some damage, and you're going to get this.
And the damage isn't just -2 off of your health points. It's -2, and now your arm is broken, which means you can't do certain things.
Yeah, right.
That's fun.
So you can really mess with the investigators, and you can kind of psych them out, because if they see that hand of Mythos cards and trauma cards, it can really start to freak them out a little bit. You'll have a separate step where your monsters attack, and then what I think is neat is they have event cards, so it kind of tells the story of the whole scenario. There's 5 per story. And kind of at the end of your turn, you just put a counter on it, a time counter. And the card will say how many counters it has to reveal it. And you'll reveal it, and it's usually a good kind of way for the investigators to keep pace. Because some of them will say if the investigators have not found the first clue, they all take a damage. And so the investigators can kind of gauge how they're doing compared to the time. Because once the deck runs out, it's either a defeat for the investigators or a defeat for everyone.
believe it's a defeat for everyone.
Yeah. So they kind of want to avoid that. You know, sometimes the best they can play to is a stalemate. But
I thought that was really cool because you sort of felt like it made up for if you weren't doing very well in the game. Well, you still had to take damage or something like that. But if you didn't find clue number one by the first part, then a lot of times it was reveal clue number one, or it's like. Reveal objective. Yeah, you kind of get caught up with the story, even if you weren't able to find everything that you needed.
Yeah, it really gives the effect of time passing in the story. You know, you're not just, to me, it's not like Betrayal where you're just kind of wandering around this house ad nauseum and stuff happens, but there's no real feeling of time progressing or a story progressing. Where this really, oh man, now it's midnight and all this stuff's happening. Now it's one, all this stuff is happening. So it's a really neat effect. The keeper turn is. There's a lot going on, but it's very just compacted and it's pretty quick. I didn't take a turn longer than 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah, and the investigator turn kind of works in a very similarly. The keeper will take their turn, and then each investigator will have a turn. It involves a movement step and then an action step. And so the movement step is basically that you can move your figure to an adjacent space. And you can move. You take two movement steps during your turn, so it basically gives you the option to move into two locations. The tiles are divided up in kind of a neat way in that, the artwork is very cool as far as it shows kind of an overall an aerial view of a house without a roof on it, basically, so you can see into the different rooms. And then within each tile there are rooms, and then within each room there are like spaces, and they're outlined with sort of a white line. So a big room might have 3 or 4 spaces in it that you're gonna that you can travel to, and you get two movement points to move to adjacent spaces, and then you get an action step in which you get to do one of a number of different things. One of those things is you can run, which means you can move an additional space. So if you're trying to get somewhere fast, you can do that as your entire turn. You have card abilities that can provide different kinds of actions. It was very similar to another Corey Kaniska game, Battlestar Galactica, in that you'd see cards in the game that had, in big bold text, action on them. I think this is really cool. I think this might be just like kind of a Corey thing of the way he designs games, but I really like that the game tells you can take an action, and then it becomes very, very easy to figure out what actions are. I found in games sometimes that have an action step to them, as the game teacher, people will be asking me questions of, well, can I do this on my turn? Can I do that on my turn? And I'm looking up in the rule book to find out if they can do that. But, here it's a little straightforward of, this thing that's on my card, can I do that as an action? Well, does it have the word action next to it? No. Yes. Okay, well, then you can. So I thought that was a really nice way that's designed. You can attack monsters that are in your space, and then probably the main thing that you can do on your turn is to explore a room. Well, that's not the main thing, but it's one of the main things.
That's the bread and butter.
Yeah, that's what you're trying to do, is explore the house. And so when you explore, that involves those decks of cards that have been seated by the keeper in the game. And you're basically going to pick that deck of cards up and hand it to the keeper. The keeper will then turn over the top card and will sort of go through this deck of cards. If there's no obstacles or locks or anything like that, then he's basically just going to give you everything that you found in the room. It might be items. It might be
nothing of value.
The very irritating card of you find nothing of value.
Times 8. Yeah.
But you also might find that a room is locked when you try to go into it. The first card that's on top has a big lock on it, and that's where some of the puzzles happen in this game. And Jeremy, could you go into the puzzles a little bit and sort of how that works?
Yeah, the puzzles are kind of like they're laid out in front of you, and there's different ones. Some of them look like portraits, some of them look like locks. And what you have to do is you have to physically put these together in a random manner and then put them back into its original format. So basically it's a way to bog down the game a little bit and slow the investigator's progress on exploring the mansion. The cool thing about the puzzle mechanic is that if you aren't able to complete it with all of your available actions, that you can leave the puzzle where it is so that another investigator can come up on the following turn and be able to figure that out, or that on your following turn, you can go back into it and try to work it out. Some people don't like the puzzle mechanic. I actually find it to be quite unique because there's nothing else out there that's quite like it. One of the things I would like to see in future expansions is that they maybe come out with larger puzzles that would take multiple turns to be able to do. Because most of them, once you've played them a couple times, you know the way they're supposed to be set up and they become second nature.
Right.
Yeah, I found that the number of puzzles per scenario has been pretty good. There's enough to where it's interesting, and I guess it's a it's a possible threat. You know, if the investigator sees a lock and they're like, well, it might be a puzzle. Or I thought it was nice. You know, you're not doing a puzzle every other turn, but there's enough in there where it's a really neat mechanic and it gets to come out and shine. And I haven't been forced to break out the timer yet, but there's been a few instances where I've wanted to, all right, let's go. You got a minute.
Well, To that point, it's interesting that the way that you take puzzle actions is based upon the intelligence of your character. Mm-hmm. So, and that of course thematically makes a lot of sense. So you are going to, you know, get to move tiles and draw tiles and replace tiles based upon, you know, you get a certain number of points to do that with. And I found that if you, it provides a nice tension in the game, because if you finish a puzzle and, you know, you're one tile off or you're one movement off and you run out of your intelligence points, you have to then decide, well, one, do I tell my compatriots, my fellow investigators, hey, you need to come and help me with this? Or do you say, well, I'm going to take another turn and try to open it again? Or, you know, the maniacs and the Shoggoths are bearing down on you. You know, it really provides some tension as to what are you going to do? Do you really want to take another turn to try to get in? Is this room even important? Yeah, because there's even some like red herring rooms in the game, really. You know, mm-hmm. not to give too much away about how that works, but
yeah, what I like is that they have the rule where other investigators cannot help you, you know, even non-verbally, because that takes away from sometimes you get with cooperative games where you have the one guy. You know, if you have the puzzle guy in your group, he's just going to go over to your side of the table and flip, there you go. I think that combined with the number of actions is based on the character, not you, the person. You know, if you're not so good at the puzzles, it gives you a little something to hide behind, you know, because it's like, well, I don't have any help, and my guy only has a 5 intellect, so yeah. I'm doing what I can here.
And you can see on the card that there's a lock on it, so you know there's going to be some sort of lock, so you can decide whether you want to actually even go into that mm-hmm. room or not. So that is, you know, it's kind of the basics of the game. The flow of the game was that you'll have your keeper turn, and then you'll have each investigator taking a turn.
You may want to talk just a bit about objectives. Or the objective, I should say.
Okay, so in each of these scenarios, there's going to be kind of a main objective in the game that you aren't really aware of until a certain point happens. Either you find 3 clues.
Or various amount of clues.
A certain number of clues. Mm-hmm. Or that a particular card gets turned over, an event card, right? Mm-hmm. That eventually will reveal that objective.
Which usually, if it's the event card that's flipping it over, you're running behind.
Yeah, TikTok. Yeah. And so that's going to reveal how the investigators win the game and then also how the keeper wins the game.
And the unique thing is that the investigators have no idea what the objective is at the start of the game, where the keeper is already starting to build momentum and knows exactly what he needs to do and able to win. So it's always in the best interest of the investigators to explore as much of the mansion as they can as quickly as possible, but at the same time not try to overextend themselves or separate themselves from all the different monsters and creatures and other effects that will be taking place.
Right, and that's where I think this game totally beats Betrayal at House on the Hill all over the place, because I feel like when I play Betrayal at House on the Hill, you're just wandering around the mansion, just kind of trying to run out the clock. You know, yep. You're just trying to wait until you get enough stuff to trigger the haunt, and that's when the real fun of the game happens. But in this one, it feels there's a lot more purpose in it, that, you know, you can have a little more control over when that objective gets revealed.
Not only that, it's really story-driven. You can say Betrayal is story-driven as well, but even all the cards included in Mansions of Madness, all the combat cards have theme text to them. So if you're really into making sure that you deliver a good story, and if the investigator is a good investigator, you can really get into the story quite well. And it's just a completely different and unique experience than you get with Betrayal.
Yeah, what's cool about it is with the clue cards, and even the introductory text, it's not just all fluff flavor text. Like, there are clues to the scenario that you're doing.
You have to listen.
Yeah, you have to listen and kind of, you know, some of them are more obvious than others. But, you know, there's definite things, if you pick up on it, you know, that might give you a leg up on where to go, what to investigate. And it's just really neat, except for the going through the combat cards, a lot of the humanoids like to go after your face. That's what we noticed.
Yeah.
Like, he goes after your face with a knife.
He chews on your face.
He chews on your face. I'm like, my goodness.
All about the faces.
But yeah, what I said when we finished our first game was, I feel like I just kind of played a one-off of Call of Cthulhu, like the role-playing game, you know? Yeah. And, you know, I don't play that game regularly. I play it at a con here or there. But to me, that was like, I've got a good board game experience. I got a role-playing experience to a point. You know, there's not a lot of acting going on, but you know, the stories are good, what I've seen of them, and it's if you have everyone really getting into it, like Jeremy said, it can be just really evocative and get a good experience out of it.
it's definitely a story experience, which I think is really good because, like Jeremy said, the cards having that theme text on them. The combat system, which we didn't really talk about, is interesting in that depending on whether the monster is attacking you or you're attacking the monster, and then what kind of weapon you have when you're attacking the monster will determine what card is drawn. And also what kind of monster will determine that as well. And so the card will get drawn, and it'll say something like, you know, the monster attacks your face, and then it'll have a dice rolling situation where you're going to roll a particular skill. If you have a gun or something, you might roll your marksmanship skill, and it's real similar to Call of Cthulhu, actually, in that the Cthulhu role playing game, you roll percentile dice to roll under a certain skill. Here it's kind of simplified in that you're rolling a 1d10 to roll under a single digit skill.
It's actually one of the more simple FFG combat games out there. I mean, you look at like Civilization and Rune Wars, and they use a lot of heavy card text, even Dungeon Quest. Yep. I mean, they're just all card driven, and this just really simplifies it down to one card and a dice roll.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
And what's neat is that it causes you to think on your feet a little bit, because even if you have a gun, every card is not just going to be test marksmanship.
Right.
A lot of it may be, oh, you fumble your gun, test dexterity. And even if you succeed, you're doing damage -1, or, you know, you're doing less than that. Or conversely, you know, it's like if you have a blunt weapon, you get a really good hit on it. And then even on a failure, you still do weapon damage, or you stun the monster. Whereas if you hit, you do weapon damage, you know, +3 or +4. So it's kind of neat. There's a lot of them are just the bread and butter, you know, deal weapon damage or you miss. But there's enough in there where there can be kind of a tension. It's like, oh, I hope I get the good action.
Yeah. The one thing that we didn't know going into the very first game that I kind of flipped through the cards to see afterwards is if you don't have any weapons, is it really worth it to try to attack? And it really is, because there's even cards where you can do up to, you know, 2 points of damage with no weapon, because of like what you're saying there, that sort of themey text there. But I was worried that I was Sister Mary or whatever her name was, you know, and she's gonna go up there and, you know, punch the maniac, you know. But you know, she could have had some success with that. So that was an awful lot of fun too. So basically, the game will continue taking these turns until you get through this, you know, this deck of event cards. And with those little time tokens sort of counting down. And usually, I take that back. I've only played the game once. I have no idea what usually it is. Maybe Jeremy can speak to that more. But a lot of times there would be sort of a battle with a big bad guy at the end, maybe.
Maybe without spoiling. But yeah. I mean, you're going to play through all those clue cards, and the game's going to end in one of two basic ways. One, you get to the last event card, and basically nobody wins, and it's a stalemate. The other one is you get to the last clue, and one of them complete that objective. And the objectives are actually quite different from one another. I mean, they all kinds of things, from resurrecting something, letting something bad come out of the house. I mean, without spoiling too much, there's just a lot of different cool things that can happen.
Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of variety that goes beyond, you know, like with Descent, just in general. And Descent has a lot of stuff too, but you know, a lot of times that is just beat the big monster at the end of the dungeon. I mean, that's kind of just a basic overview of how the game works. Let's talk a little second about sort of our how we do our reviews here. Cody, how do we do our reviews here?
Well, here on Game On with Cody and John, we use the buy, try, or deny system.
Trademark, patent pending.
That's right. We'll give our buy points that we think are great and what would make you go out and buy this game tomorrow. We have try points, which will tell you what may be good for some, not as good for others. You want to try it out and see if it's for you. And then deny points, points that we think are bad and black marks on the game in general.
Well done.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So, Cody, we'll start with you since you did that so well. What are your buy points for Mansions of Madness?
It's a great game. And I think it mixes so many great things from other games. And it comes out with this game that I didn't think would be any good. I remember when they first announced it, and I was like, oh, it's a Cthulhu Descent clone. It's not going to be any good. I just kind of thumbed my nose at it. I'm like,
I felt the same way.
We'll see, you know. But for me, I mean, this Jones theories out at least three games. I mean, I think this is better than Betrayal. I'm not the biggest Betrayal fan anyway, but, you know, I commented to John, this is like Betrayal grown up. You know, Betrayal seems very juvenile, and then you play this, it's like, oh, I have that same exploration feeling, but... You know, it feels balanced. I think at Arkham Horror, you know, it's a different play style to be sure, but you get that same theme. And I would say Mansions even does it better, because Arkham, you're just kind of running around closing gates. And getting older signs. And then Descent, you know, I think Descent, for what it is, can become very bloated very quickly. A lot to do, just a lot of fiddly actions, where Mansions, there can be a lot going on, but the mechanics are simple enough to where once you get this game down, I mean, you know, 3 hours tops, I think. I mean, you can knock this out 2 hours probably.
Yeah.
And it just feels very polished. It feels quick, but you still feel like you get a deep experience. And like I mentioned earlier, having that story-driven thing where the text matters, that really was a home run for me. So the fact that it combines so many games and that it executes on its theme that well, those are all buy points for me.
Excellent. Jeremy, what did you think?
I would agree with all those points. The production values are through the roof. All the miniatures in there, I mean, they're incredibly well done. All the artwork is incredibly well done. And you look at games like Betrayal, and you look at the artwork, and it's got maybe a single picture on there. Here they have artwork for almost all the cards, which is just phenomenal. The same thing, that it's really intuitive. I mean, you can play it once, and then you understand it. Whereas you play Descent, and it is convoluted, and there's so many rule sets in Descent that you just have to spend a lot of time, and it's got a very high entry level to even learning the base game. This game, you can sit down with a good keeper and learn it almost instantly. It's got very few rules to it. There's basically, as you said, there's two basic actions, moving and exploring, and maybe some other little things set in, but there's not a whole lot to it. And the story is what keeps me coming back. It's very fulfilling, I think, is what my game group said, is that once you play it, you feel like you've just experienced something that no other board game really gives that to you. It's story-driven, so you feel like you've been a part of this cool story, and it's really unique.
Yeah. I'll echo all of those points. I think that's the ease of teaching. That's always something that I tend to key in on, is how easy is it to teach new players. And I think that if you're a keeper who's read through the rules and has, you know, set the game up, and you kind of know what's going on, it's real easy to teach. I'll be very surprised if I don't see this being played many, many times at Origins and Gen Con this year, and, you know, and other open gaming cons, because it is something I think that, much like Descent, it's something that it's a big, rich experience that people want to have, and a lot of people can't afford the $80, so they'll go to a convention and play someone else's copy of it. I mean, but I think this is a better convention game even than Descent.
Oh,
because
easily.
I would much rather run this at a game convention than run Descent, because I spent half my time in Descent. Oh, what does Blast do? Okay, well, Blast does this. And Knockback does this, which is different from Sweep, which is, you know, there's just so many picky details. And so I'll go ahead and start my try points, because that sort of leads into my couple of concerns I have about the game going forward. The game as a product unto its own, I think, is just fantastic. And so just right out of the box, it's great, a great game. I do have concerns that the Fantasy Flight Games expansion machine could add a lot of complexity to this. This is just speculation, but I know that in previous expansions for things like Arkham Horror and Descent, you know, they add so many things and so much extra stuff, room tiles, and I, you know, adding scenarios and adding stories to this game, I think, is very important, because I think that's almost some sort of semi-necessary to keep this game fresh over many years. I mean, if you play it on a regular basis, because you will eventually run out of the stories. But so if they're able to keep a good flow of stories and other situations and products coming onto the market, I think that will really help to add to the game. But my hope is that it doesn't become bloated and the rules become, you know, you don't find yourself in 2 years longing for the base game, you know, and wishing that they had added all this stuff to it, like Talisman with 1,000 expansions.
Yeah.
You know? So, Cody, your try points.
Well, I echo your concern that, you know, I kind of want the first few expansions to just be stories and maybe a new character or two.
Yeah.
You know, one try point I would say is the replayability. Now, a lot of people I've seen on Board Game Geek are very worried about it. They're like, oh, it's only got 5 scenarios. I think that this will hold you over until their first inevitable expansion. I think a lot of the to-do about the limited replayability is rubbish. I think you will get enough in the base box to keep you plenty busy for a while. Even the 3 sub-scenarios for each story are different enough, quite different enough, I would say, that you can get a good experience out of it. My try point is that, you know, if you're playing this all the time, maybe you'll run out of stuff. I don't know if you would. My other one is to me, kind of a duh one, but I want to throw it out there, is that the theme may not be for everyone. Mm. I mean, it's Cthulhu to the max. You know, you've got seances, you've got, you know, things exploding out of people's bodies and all sorts of that. So
Horror. Because that's a horror.
Indeed. But just keep that in mind. I mean, that's kind of a... I've played with people who like the game and the mechanics and the kind of mystery of it, but not so much the Cthulhu and the horror theme. So I don't mind it. I think it's fine. It pulls it off well, but just throwing that out there as a teaser there.
Jeremy? Wow. I go against the grain on both of you. I want more expansions. I want more stuff for it. I want it to be a little more complex than what it already is, because it does seem very vanilla right now. And I don't mind adding some more complexity to it. I like the idea of adding more explorers and definitely more stories, but I'd like to see more villains. I'd like to see some new cards, which I guess I'll get into in the deny part. Mm-hmm. But I really don't have any try. I think people should go out and buy it.
All right, there you go. You've heard it from Dragonstrike. Well, then, tell us your deny points.
Great. I mentioned this in the review as well. It seems like it's a little difficult for the investigators to always have their way. You have these trauma cards for the keepers, and they're very powerful at times. And I've played several games, even since the review, where we've lost our weapons on the first two or three turns, all of our weapons. And the mansion may not be seated with any other firearms, so you lose your investigator's base powers from them. For instance, Michael McGlynn, I believe, is one of the people who starts off with a ranged weapon. Mm-hmm. Once you lose that ability from them, they become fairly worthless. They're basically punching Shaggoths in the face with their fist. And you do one hit point to them, and it's basically just a running. Now, most people say, well, this is Cthulhu. This is what's supposed to happen. You're not supposed to fight. But it's not always the most fun thing to do either, by running around and having to avoid everything, especially that early in the game. So I think they have to come out with something, maybe a mechanic where if someone plays a trauma card on you, you can roll for your luck and be able to negate that trauma card. Something as simple as that, or some kind of events where the investigators have an ability to hurt the keeper as well. And I think that's something that most people are going to discover within their first couple games. And that may be a factor that people aren't going to like about the game.
John?
Yeah, I don't really have any deny points, but I've only played it one full time, you know, so I have the least amount of experience with it. So I had a great experience with it, so I really can't speak to anything. At this point, it was enough for me to go ahead and purchase it, so I'm sitting and looking at the box right now. But
Longingly,
yes. Cthulhu is staring at me. But no, I don't have any deny points for this one. I mean, the price, but, you know, this is par for the course for Fantasy Flight and for this caliber and size of game.
You pay for.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm normally the price prude, but yeah. I feel this is fair.
It's $80 retail, and if that's out of your price range, then that's just out of your price range. You're not going to do anything about that. But I think that comparable to other games of its size and scope and component quality, I think it's right in line there. Cody?
Thanks. I might be reaching here, but my only deny point would be setup time. And even with repeated plays, there's still just a lot of man hours to be put into it. I mean, it's...
Man minutes,
yeah. your first time setting up is going to take a while, but that's to be expected. But even with multiple plays, the keeper really needs to just put some time in and get it done. So
more so than Descent? I just as a comparison, or no? Just curious. Yeah.
Maybe on par, maybe slightly more. I mean, Descent, I don't know, you kind of slap everything down and...
Depends on how many expansions of Descent you have.
Descent base game
can be overly long.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, Descent base game, I would say Mansions has a longer setup time, but Descent, you know, Road to Legend with all that crap.
Yeah.
You know, it's still going to... It's Descent, you know.
Because as someone who's attempting to subscribe to the Jones Theory, mm-hmm. Which I don't know if Jeremy's familiar.
I don't know what
but,
it is, no.
All right. So the Jones Theory is basically Cody's idea that he put out about 2 years ago, something like that, that in everyone's game collection, they should have... they should select whether to keep a game based upon either a particular mechanic or a particular theme, which means that if, for example, you want a cooperative game with a traitor in it, well, then you should only have one cooperative game with a traitor in your collection. There's, because one will always rise to the top over another.
I subscribe to that, absolutely. I believe that's a real theory.
Fist down there, yeah.
Look at this guy.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, we're always kind of looking for ways to Jones Theory our collections, and you know, and so for this one, is this a Descent killer?
Oh yeah.
for absolutely. Okay, Cody says yes.
Well, I mean, with an asterisk there, I play D&D weekly, so D&D is my descent killer, but all things being equal, I think...
With a different theme. Yeah, with the clarification that that's by descent killer, meaning that it's a game that is, you know, many people versus one overlord style character.
Yeah, on mechanics alone, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay.
Yeah, I think maybe for me too. So as I look longingly at my copy of Descent when I get back home, we'll see. Okay. All right, so that is Mansions of Madness. You guys, overall, I mean, it seems like overall we had a real, you know, positive view of the game.
Buy it today.
Give it a buy. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, outstanding. Well, Jeremy, again, thanks for joining us for the review. And let's move on.
All right, it's time for the Game On Inbox, where we have all of the latest news and the feedback from you, the listener. First thing John has is a follow-up on our Battleship Galaxies report from last episode.
Yeah, I mentioned in our last episode some news about the New York Toy Fair. We talked about a couple of different things, one of which being the Battleship Galaxies game that's going to be coming out from Hasborg. And and it looked like this has sort of a HeroScape feel to it, and it has miniatures, and looked actually kind of cool for, you know, for being a big mass-marketed game. Well, here's why it looks cool. It turns out that the designers of this game are Colby Dowk from the designer of Summoner Wars, Craig Van Ness, who designed many games that we like, such as HeroScape and Sorry Sliders, and Jerry Hawthorne, who's also a designer in HeroScape. So those guys are the ones that are making Battleship Galaxy. So, I mean,
why did they kill HeroScape?
It seems like if they're going to bring in all this people from HeroScape, they could just make HeroScape.
Yeah.
So anyway, but you know, keep an eye out for that one, because it's, you know, with that caliber of designer, could end up being a decent game. We'll see what Hasbro does with it.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
know, hopefully they can support it. So another piece of news just from Fantasy Flight Game is in the long line of deck building games here, we've got, you know, now the entry, one of the entries from Fantasy Flight, and that is Rune Age. Once again, squeezing blood from the Terranoth turnip.
That's right.
And it's going to be set in the Terranoth world of Descent and Rune Wars and all that kind of stuff. And looks, you know, like it's going to be, you know, somewhat interesting, I guess. I had a question about that, you know, just with all these deck building games coming out. I mean, are we kind of reaching a critical mass with deck building games? What do you think, Cody? Dominion's been out for like 3 years now, and now we've seen so many other deck building games come out.
I'm surprised at how many there are, you know, just coming. It seems like every month there's a new deck building game, and I think this is a topic we're actually going to delve into more deeply on our next episode.
I think so. Nice tease.
Thank you.
All right, so yeah, be on the lookout for that, though. If you're a fan of deck building games, you know, Fantasy Flight, you know, you got to know it's going to be great artwork and great quality of components. So we'll see what the rules, when the rules come out, we'll get back
with
you.
We'll take a look.
Yep. I also want to mention to you, any of you folks who might be coming to Gen Con in August, of course, being the gaming capital of the world, we want to keep you up to date on all the Gen Con information. You know, if you haven't gotten your badge yet, badge registration is open right now, so you can go on GenCon.com and register there and get your badge for Best 4 Days in Gaming. And one of the big milestones of the year is, when does event registration start?
The biggest train wreck of the year.
The biggest train wreck. And it always seems like every year, you know, everybody flocks to the website to try to sign up for True Dungeon and all those kind of things on the very first day. And it always just breeds a whole lot of bitterness and frustration, and, you know, lots of posts on the Gen Con community forums of people.
Here's what happens.
Okay.
Every year, everyone tries to get on there, and it always fails. And then there's the wailing and gnashing of teeth. And then there's kind of the cute, pithy email from, you know, the CEO of Gen Con or whoever at the time. It's like, oh, we're working to fix it. And everyone's like, oh, shucks. You know, they took the time to email. And then
so
it's
much.
Crap the next year.
Yeah.
And I was preaching this last year. So apparently they're going to attempt to test it out. The event reg is May 1st this year. They're going to be doing some load testing and some open testing on it. I'm going to be the super cynic, and I'll believe it when I see it, because – at least they're making some effort, which good on them. But
yeah, and this is something that I don't think they've done to this extent before. Mm-hmm. So we'll, you know, so, and I'm just going to read what the press release says here. It says, we'll be conducting an open test of event registration in about a month and wanted to give everyone the heads up. We're going to set up a test version of our event registration website in late March that anyone can access to help test. Testers will have about a week to select test events for themselves and all their friends. Get as many as you like. They won't cost a thing, and the more the better. Sometime in early April, we'll have an event registration test opening where everyone can click the button to get their tickets at the same time. So, you know, like Cody mm-hmm. said, just load testing here. And so, you know, you can be a part of that if you want to. So if you aren't signed up with GenCon.com to get like email updates and that kind of stuff, be sure to do that so you can find out more about that stuff. So, you know, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, one other piece of Gen Con news, you know, True Dungeon, a favorite event of ours, they're going to 10-person parties this year. So I believe it's still going to be like $40 a ticket. But if you're going to Gen Con and you haven't done True Dungeon, we highly recommend it. Yes, the price is up there, but it's worth doing at least once. It's a staple of my Gen Con every year, so definitely check that out.
All right, cool. Well, let's move on to listener feedback. And we got a ton of it because we, you know, we had our contest where we're going to be giving away some reinforcement packs for Summoner Wars mm-hmm. and a special promo card as well. But we also got some emails that and voicemails that didn't have anything to do with the contest. So, Cody, why don't you give us one of those?
All right, our first email is, I'm going to try this two different ways. One of them will be closer to right, I think.
Okay.
It's either Michael L. LaCroix Falish or Michael L. LaCroix Fralish. We'll go.
It's probably a third. That's exactly.
We'll go French and Hoosier there.
But thank you for writing.
Yeah, he goes, hi guys, love the podcast. We have a regular group playing FFG's Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. Ooh. We just finished with a long adventure, and the group really wants to get the GM a gift to show our appreciation for all the hard work she did running this campaign. We're having a hard time figuring out what would be a good gift. Can you guys help with suggestions? A
bottle of whiskey?
No, first, I salute you for really thinking of your GM. I know that sometimes the GM could just be thought of as, yep, you're going to provide the fun, and no real thought to how much time that really takes.
Yeah, that's nice. That's nice.
I would say if there's a certain game component that she's looking for, or a source book, I don't really follow Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay that much, or, you know, you can never go wrong, maybe with Warhammer you could, like a really nice set of dice or something, like one of the nice premium sets of dice, or just some cool, you know, geek thing, you know, like a Knights of the Dinner Table bust, you know, yeah, I just think that would be neat.
If you go to thinkgeek.com, that's a website that's just got a lot of great geeky stuff. And Cody and I each have the LED lit D20 where, you know, you roll a 20-sided die and if it comes up as a 20, it flashes red light. So, you know, that might be a good resource. That website just has a lot of great geeky stuff there. So, but yeah, hey, kudos to you for thinking of your GM there. So, I mean, I remember the nice GM gift that I got when I finished my Road Trader campaign. Do you remember that, Cody?
Yep. No.
No,
you didn't. It wasn't a long campaign. It was a 4-session campaign.
But I put my heart and soul into that for 4 whole sessions.
It was only 4 sessions.
Okay.
All right. Our next email comes from Mike Levitt. And to summarize, he calls me out because I like to be Mr. Graphic Design Snob.
Yes.
A lot.
Oh, yes.
It turns out.
You made the logo. I did make, I did make the logo.
I did make the logo. It's a beautiful logo. It turns out that the typeface that's on the London game box is not, in fact, Times New Roman, but it is Garamond Premier Pro Semi-Bold. And he could not let me sully the good name of Claude Garamond and his inspired typeface. And he even sent me a chart to show me where the serifs match up and everything.
It's a big screen capture from his computer.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in design stuff, typography is my big thing, and I was lazy. I just looked across the table. I thought it was Times New Roman. So, Mike, I applaud you, and I'll even do a little.
Very nice, very nice.
Yeah. Well done, and I was completely wrong, so nice catch there. All right, next email we have is from, I believe it's Matan Heiselt.
I think it's Mathen.
Mathen? Okay. Yeah. I try to just get too fancy.
I met him, he and his wife at Origins. I think his wife's name is Brenda.
Oh.
But that's my mom's name, so it's easy for me to remember that. So
cool story. He says, hey, Cody,
please
John,
proceed.
Thanks for the podcast. It's fast becoming one of my favorites. Thank you. You had reviewed Puzzle Strike on your last podcast and referenced the design on the chips. Just FYI, I was the designer of the chip version of Dominion. There he is. But was not involved in Puzzle Strike at all. The design was, quote, borrowed. A nod from the designer would have been nice, but whatever.
Dun, dun, dun.
I thought they would have asked him just because it's such a blatant ripoff of that.
Yeah.
So, man, that's too bad.
Interesting.
And the final email I want to read, it hits me close to home. And it's from Peter Venables. And he says, hi, Cody and John.
Can you read the title of the email?
It says Schmoen's Theory.
Schmoen's Theory.
He goes, I'm a couple of years into this brilliant hobby. It's felt such a short time since I got Carcassonne 2 years ago, and since then I found BGG and Meteor, and in my view, more engaging games, and now, like many, my cupboards are bursting at the seams, and I'm looking for a new storage solution with the number of games I've got. I've been lucky enough that my beautiful wife Liz has come with me on this journey, as have my two kids, who are at 5 and 3, and love a game of Animal Upon Animal, Formula D, or The Black Pirate. Animal Upon Animal? What's that about?
No, it's like a stacking game. You have these little wooden animals, and you have to stack them.
Yeah. My mind was in a different place. And while Liz's tastes are probably slightly lighter than mine, there's plenty of overlap and opportunity for gaming fun. Anything from Ticket to Ride to a shared love of Dominion and Race for the Galaxy, and probably up to an infrequent 1960 Making of the President at the heaviest.
Outstanding. Nope. That's such a good game.
Yeah, okay. So basically, to summarize a little bit, he goes in and he's explaining the Jones Theory to his wife, Liz. And let me quote this, Liz thought that this was ridiculous.
Oh.
She actually said, what, shouldn't that be more like keep San Juan and Race for the Galaxy and then find 5 more games like that? And he says, I think she has a point. For the common gamer without too much time to spend, we should definitely try new stuff when and where you can, but rather than Jones Theory, it's surely better to find what you really like, play it a lot, and allow for variety within those genres. So now they're kind of Liz theorying their collection and just in blatant disregard for the Jones Theory, thumbing their nose at it.
I can answer this question for you because I know what you're going to say.
Okay.
It's fine. It's fine if the games get to the table. It seems to me like the whole point of the Jones Theory is getting games to the table, right?
Right. Don't waste your money.
Don't waste your money. Get the games to the table. So if you buy 5 or 6 things that are the same type and they all get equally to the table, then you'd be fine with that, right?
Yes, but they're not going to.
Go ahead.
Because you can. I think it's a good idea. I think it's a sound idea. But I think maybe for that first month or two, you'll spread out all 5 or 6 evenly, and then the cream's just going to rise to the top. You're going to start bringing out 1 or 2. More than the others, and then the other ones are just going to sit there and gather dust. I could be wrong. You could be playing all 5 of them equally within a year's time. Then Liz Theory, all you want, but I just don't think that would stick.
All right.
But it's an interesting. I never thought of it that way, and it's a interesting school of thought. I don't know. I just don't see 5 or 6 games of the same type, unless that's all you play.
I think that does not promote the well-rounded gamer, which is what we promote on Game On with Cody and John. So I think you need to try lots of different things, and pigeonholing yourself to one kind of game, I'm not so sure about that. So.
And so thanks a lot, Pete, for that. And he has a PS. He chides me for cheering on Tottenham Hotspur as he is an Arsenal fan. Come on, the Tottenham logo is a gamecock on a soccer ball. I mean, that's how can you beat that?
What's Arsenal's logo? Do you know?
It's a cannon. It's like a crest, but it has a cannon on it.
Cannon's pretty cool.
Yeah, but it's, you know, think like British people, you know, an arse, Arsenal, you know, like a butt, an arse. Okay. I know we're a family show, but.
Really? Is that like a common.
Moving on to the voicemail.
Derisive comment to Arsenal fans?
Sure. I don't know.
Great Britain on.
Go Spurs.
All right. So before we get into the contest entries here for our Summoner Wars contest, we did have one voicemail from a listener who wanted to thank us. So and thank all of you as well. So let's have a listen.
Hi, Cody and John. It's Kevin from Plymouth, Minnesota. I just wanted to call and let you know. I keep forgetting to tell you guys. Your community was fantastic on Board Game Geek. They helped me find a game that was under $20 for my brother for Christmas. I ended up picking up Lost Cities, which I think he enjoyed. The theme didn't relate as well to the mechanic as I would have liked, but it was a lot of fun. I also just had a quick question for you. Is it okay to hate games that you're just plain not good at? When I first played Carcassonne, I thought it was fun. But I'm just not very good at it, and I'm starting to hate it because of that. Is that fair, or is that a type of thing where you guys think you should keep trying? I'll be listening. Bye.
All right, so Kevin, thanks so much for that voicemail, and you know you're welcome. And then thanks to the Board Game Geek Guild community there for Game of Thrones.
Yeah, good to see the folks heed the call and jump on there.
Lost Cities is a great game, and I mean it's a Kenichi game. What are you going to do? The theme's just not going to match up with it. But your question there, is it okay to hate games that you're not any good at? Cody, what do you think about that?
Yeah, to a point. I mean, that was kind of the start of my Carcassonne hate, and then it branched into just didn't like the game, but. You know, as I mentioned earlier, innovation, that's a game I'm just god awful at. I'm just so bad at it. But I still like it and I can appreciate it. So I'd say definitely try it a few times, but if you don't like it, you don't have to make excuses to anyone.
Because it depends on the game, because I always say when I do rules reviews, the object of the game is to win. It is, but really the object is to have fun. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of games that I play that I don't win, they're still fun. So if you're able to play the game and you lose at it, but you still feel like you're having a good time, well, then that's great, you know. But I know, I think it's okay that if you play something over and over again and you're just not having a good time because you are terrible at it, then yeah, just drop it. There's too many games out there.
Now, I'm undefeated at Mansions of Madness. That's why I got such a glowing review from me.
That was it. You start losing at that game, yeah. And it'll be, yeah. Jump we'll take a second look at that in like a year. You'll be like, terrible game. All right, so Kevin, thanks so much for that voicemail. All right, so now let's talk a little bit about our contest where we're going to be giving away 2 reinforcement packs for Summoner Wars. And we asked a very simple question and about sort of the future of Game On with Cody and John. We asked if you could add, subtract, or change one thing about Game On with Cody and John, what would it be? Cody, if you could add, subtract, or change one thing about Game On, what would it be?
I don't know.
Okay, the fact that you didn't say John right away.
Well, I wanted to be polite.
but don't worry about our opinions because we got plenty from our listeners. We got a really great response. Thanks so much to everybody who wrote in.
Great response, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, just to kind of summarize, I'll tell you what, before we summarize some of the things, we do want to play a few of the voicemails that we got because we did say that if you send us a voicemail or call the Game On hotline, that you would get 2 entries to the contest, and we were faithful to that. So here's a couple of the voicemails that we got from you, the listeners.
Hi, guys. This is Ben from Madison, Wisconsin, or Storms Bowler on the Geek. You mentioned that you were looking for feedback on ways to improve Game On and that a voicemail would be worth 2 entries into your contest. So I'm going to earn those 2 entries by providing you with 2 suggestions I think would make your show even better. First, I think one of the real strong points of the show is that you both really seem to enjoy putting out the podcast, and there's a lot of great banter and conversation between the two of you. As a result, you also have by far the funniest outtakes of any podcast I listen to. I'd like to suggest that you don't hold any of the lively conversation or the outtakes back. Just keep us laughing. Second, I really enjoyed your recent appearance on the Dice Tower. I think that's a great idea to continue that podcast cross-pollination by inviting the hosts from other board game podcasts to join you for conversation on your show. I think that can only improve all the podcasts if you share your different styles and views with each other. Anyway, thanks for continuing to put out an informative and entertaining show. Bye.
All right, Ben. Well, thanks so much for that suggestion to keep the funny rolling. You know, I mean, we want to keep it a family show. So
yeah. I mean, John messes up a lot. So you know,
I do.
The blooper reel, just keep rolling.
I'm also sitting here with my hand on the stop button of the recorder. So yep. I'm the editor too. Yep. So the more I screw up, the more longer it takes.
All I did was make the logo, as you mentioned.
So. Yeah, and our appearance at the Dice Tower, we had a really great time doing that. Yeah. I hope we do get to do that in the future. And who knows? We may want to maybe start to bring in some other board game podcasters on our show. So,
absolutely.
So we can browbeat them and abuse them like Tom did to us. So Ben, thanks so much for that. And Madison, Wisconsin, that's a pretty city.
Wonderful town.
I've been there. It's an isthmus. Did you know that? There's like 2 big lakes on either side of the city.
That's cool.
Okay. All right, let's move on to this, another voicemail from one of our listeners.
Hi, this is David in Carlsbad, California. I just discovered your excellent podcast. And I'm up to about episode 20 now, so I'm working my way up through them. I salute anybody who's able to continue podcasts week after week. You guys do a great job. Here comes the but. I just have one problem. It's driving me nuts. And knowing there's probably 40 more episodes I'm going to listen to for this is continuing to happen is killing me. I don't know which one of you it is. It might be Cody. But I can't take your use, and I think misuse, of future tense. It drives me crazy. You can't say, for example, you can say your game is going to come with these things in it, or when you open it, you're going to find. That's a future tense. But then you can't say it's going to come with counters. It's going to come with these items. It's not based on time, which is how you're using it. It comes with counters. It comes with plastic pieces. It is not going to come with, okay? Now, you may have to check on with a grammar teacher or something like that. Maybe I'm not explaining it because I thought I could. but it's your constant use of future tense is incorrect. Okay? So look into it. Keep up this great job. I really mean it's a great job. But I just dreading the next 40 episodes of misused grammar. So there you go. Have a good one. Thanks.
All right, so actually, to clarify, that's John he's talking about, or that's John who he will be talking about. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Okay, David, in Carlsbad, California, thank you so much for that message. And, you know, I thought long and hard about what you said, because, and I went back and listened to a couple of my reviews, and I think I understand what you're saying, but I don't think, I'm doing it on purpose. I'm not doing it as just, I lost all my grammar rules, you know. My idea is that when I'm doing a review, I'm telling you about a game that you have not purchased yet. Yes, the game is in existence, you know, but it's something that you haven't purchased yet. So I'm thinking of it more along the lines of, when you get the game, you will get this. You know, if I were to say, when you get the game, you get this, I think it should be both in future tense, you know, that you have not gotten the components in the game yet. So you will get a board when you purchase this game that I'm telling you about. You will get meeples. So
I think it works both ways. I don't know why we're even talking about it.
Well, but, you know, this is a concern of one of our listeners. I'm trying to address
one. So thanks for the voicemail.
I will keep an eye on my grammar and we'll see how that goes.
How are you doing today, John?
I will be doing very well.
Very nice.
All right. So thanks, David. We do appreciate that suggestion there. And I'll keep an eye on the grammar. All right. So now we have an email here, or a voicemail here from Nick Peck in California. So let's have a listen.
Hi there. This is Nick Peck from San Mateo, California, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm responding to your request on episode 60 to give feedback on what I would like to, you know, see changed, what I would like to see removed from your show, and what I would like to see added. I think it's a wonderful show. I love the interplay between the two of you, and, you know, I sort of burned out on the Dice Tower and switched over to listening to you instead just because of that. I think it's a softer, warmer, you know, and very real show. Things I would like to see less of are sort of the very personal and local stuff that you guys talk about. So, you know, I'm really glad that you have a game group that's happening at a church in Indianapolis, Indiana. That's awesome for you, but it's irrelevant to me. And it's irrelevant to any listener that's not listening to you, you know, right in the middle of Indianapolis. So I would say downplaying that stuff, you know, and thinking more in terms of, stuff that people, you know, generally around the world who are interested in this hobby would listen more, I think would be a better approach. And I really, really like the fact that you guys talk about RPGs, even though we mostly play board games now. Certainly I've played Dungeons & Dragons a ton, and hearing about things like Gamma World and some of these other RPGs that you guys are focusing on that are a little bit lesser known is wonderful. And it's something that the Dice Tower doesn't do, and, you know, some of these other gaming podcasts don't do. So, in my opinion, less of the personal stuff and more of the RPG stuff, and that's it. Keep on keeping on, and I'll keep on listening. Bye.
Regarding all of the local stuff that we talk about, I mean, that's, I kind of see your point with that, I guess. You know, we do have a lot of listeners that are within driving distance, you know, and so we want to make sure that we make mention of that kind of local stuff that might be relevant to those listeners. But, you know, we do want to keep it on a global scale as well. Now, just to kind of show you...
that's like a minute of the show, though. It's I don't want to be that guy, but it's like ahead. A minute of the show.
I know
it makes you want to be... You know, sunny California, bah, you want to be here in dreary Indianapolis.
Well, this is what I love about getting all this feedback. It's one of the best parts about this show, getting voicemails and emails, because there's listeners of Game On that are all over. And so we've got Nick here in California who, you know, he has this, you know, he feels like we shouldn't be doing as much of this local stuff. But we also have this listener.
Hello, Cody and John. This is Matt Jordan, and I have been a listener of you guys, I don't know, for a better part of a year now. The first time I called in and left a message, but I wanted to let you guys know the one thing that I think that you guys could add to the podcast. I would love to hear actual feedback from maybe some of the players in your gaming groups. So after you guys have had a gaming session, maybe do some interviews with some of the players at your groups. And otherwise, I think it's a great podcast. I just think that might be kind of interesting, and other listeners might enjoy it too. So, have a good day. See ya. Bye.
So Matt actually wants us to interview local people and talk more about that. So, I mean, it's you know, more RPGs, less RPGs. It takes all kinds. So, you know, we're gonna take all of these suggestions together and, you know, just kind of boil it down to what'll end up being hopefully the best game on that we can make it. So
the temperature in Indianapolis is currently 45 degrees.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
No problem.
We got a lot of great emails as well, and a lot of those focus again on sort of the kind of content that we're doing, RPG content versus board game content. Had several people said they'd like the show to be longer, and wow, thank you, but man, I don't want to listen to myself talk any longer.
Me either.
You know, it's kind of funny. We don't actually ever set out to have our show be a particular length.
No.
And I've even heard some podcasts that have like a clock and they're watching the clock saying, oh, we're going long or whatever. We don't. We literally just sit down and say, this is what we're going to talk about and see how long it takes for it. And strangely enough, the show ends up being about an hour and 15 minutes just about every time. So we'll probably just keep doing
that.
There
you go. We might have a bit shorter reviews in the future.
Yes, that was one thing. I think of all the things that were said, this was probably said more than anything else, is that regarding the game reviews that we do, that a lot of times our rules explanation just seems a little bit too long and too detailed. And some even mentioned that there's other podcasts that do that same kind of thing and do it real well. And, you know, that might not be the best focus for us. And I think we both really agree with that. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully you heard in our Mansions of Madness review, which just happened a few minutes ago, that we really are trying to be a little bit more succinct with not giving you super, super detailed, game reviews, especially if you guys are driving in your car right now and you're not, you know, you don't have the game in front of you or the rule book. It's not going to be that helpful for us to go into a long, long explanation. So look in the future for maybe some shorter rules explanations in our reviews. Might be able to even get more reviews in per episode.
Absolutely. Now, all these people wrote in and called in for a reason.
Yes.
And that is
because they love us.
Because they love us. And because they want to win the Summoner Wars reinforcement packs and the Cyrook promo card.
Yes.
So we have gone to random.org. We have put in the numbers. And who is our winner?
Well, we want to keep in mind also that we did give two entries per voicemail. For those of you who gave the voicemails, we gave you two entries. So our the big winner. That sounds like a helicopter.
Get to the chopper.
Our big winner is Gerald from Romeoville, Illinois.
Well done. Well done, Gerald.
And Gerald sent us a voicemail, and here it is.
Hey, Game On with Cody and John. What's up? This is Gerald from Romeoville, Illinois. You guys are doing a great job on the podcast, and I just wanted to pitch in on that little contest you're having. Just wanted to say maybe if you guys can add like a little section on your website showing like the different games you guys talked about and kind of like a quick review, or I don't know. I don't know if you guys have ratings or anything on your games, but something so that other people can pop in and see what kind of games that you guys enjoyed. Anyway, keep up the good work, and hope to get those two entries into the contest. Summoner Wars is awesome. I know you guys like it too, so it's a good game. We've been playing it with a group of gaming group that we have. But keep up the good work, guys. Take it easy. Bye.
Well, we thank you, Gerald, for that, and I think it's something we can look into in the future, putting the games we've played on the website. Maybe if we both track our plays on Board Game Geek, I think they come up with a web widget that...
Oh, do they?
Yeah, so it takes what you're playing and puts it into that.
See, now that's a reason to maybe try games.
That would keep me on the wagon, as it were.
All right, we'll look into that.
Yeah, great suggestion.
That's a good idea.
And it's a good enough suggestion to win you the pack. So if you will just write us at the Game On Inbox.
GameOnInbox@gmail.com.
With your address, we will get those out to you lickety-split.
Yeah. Post-haste.
Post-haste.
All right. So thanks so much again for all that great feedback. We want to be the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer, and we got just so much great feedback from you common gamers out there, and we will take it under advisement.
All right, that wraps up another momentous episode of Game On with Cody and John.
Momentous.
Indeed. We want to give extra special thanks to Jeremy D. Salinas, a.k.a. Drakenstrike, for joining us on the show today.
And, oh, yeah. Hope that guy comes by.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a pleasure to have him on the show. Check out DrakenStrikeVideos.com, and you can see all of his fantastic work. And now that you know how much work goes into it, you can appreciate it that much more.
Well, we want to say a special thank you to listener Bay Chang, who sent us a very, very nice donation. And I don't know if Bay wanted to be recognized on the show, but we do appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And you know, we appreciate all the great financial support that we've gotten over the years. It's been a couple of years.
Yes, it has.
Yeah. And that is one of the best ways that you can say thank you to us for the show. You know, it doesn't cost that much to produce the show, but it does have some costs involved. And we want to be able to, you know, get good games in, go to events and things like that to be able to bring you the best content. And so the best way that you can do that is to click our donation button, donate on GameOnPodcast.com. It'll allow you to give via PayPal. And like I said, we really do appreciate that. Hey, we got another show coming in 2 weeks, don't we?
We do.
What are we going to be talking about?
We're going to be talking about We're going to be talking about, I'm like you. deck building games.
How are you like me?
How much is too much?
Deck building games.
Yes. And we're going to be reviewing the new hotness in deck building games, and that's Nightfall.
From AEG, yeah.
From AEG.
So if you're a card player, then you'll want to tune in for that one. But hey, even if you're not, we may even have a bonus review.
Spoiler.
I don't know. So we do appreciate all you listeners out there. We love making this podcast for you. And hey, until next time.
Game on.
This episode of Game On is sponsored by Myriad Games on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. If you'd like to contact Cody and John, send them an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com or leave a voicemail at 413-8-GAME-ON. For more content, check out our website at gameonpodcast.com. Join our guild on boardgamegeek.com and connect with other fans of the show. Become a fan of our show on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at gameonpodcast. Game On with Cody and John is a proud member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. Check out other great shows on PulpGamer.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, game on.
That's right. And we want to also thank,
Six Take Richard.
That's what they call me, Seven Take Richard.
In the studio.
You know, Eight Take Richard, that's me. And so I want to take a real quick moment just to...
You're not good at podcasting.
I never claimed to be.